Last summer, we had a really great crop of passion fruit. I reckon we had several hundred passion fruit over the summer period. Very productive. I did a few good things. I don't claim to be an expert gardener, but I prepared the ground. I watered it when needed. I fertilised it. I pruned it in early spring. And it produced great fruit. And not only that, we've got two dogs. The dogs didn't eat the vine, so they had a good chance of surviving. So that was good. In gardening, the effort that you put into preparation is usually proportional to the productivity, to the fruit that you get and the fruit you enjoy. You prepare the soil, you fertilise it at the right time, you do all the right things, and the sun and the rain does the rest. I think there's a biblical principle too there. We reap what we sow. As we look at this passage in Isaiah that's just been read to us, we have a problem. We have this parable. The first seven verses are actually a parable there of a vineyard where we see the order of things that I've just expressed reversed. Everything possible was done to produce a good crop of grapes. But there was no good fruit. Why? There appears to be no hope at all in this chapter. For example, verse 30, right at the end, it describes a hopeless situation for Judah. Darkness and distress. And interestingly, the solution is not actually found in this passage. Isaiah 5 is possibly the bleakest chapter in the book. How does it fit in context with the rest of the book? There's certainly a movement in Isaiah. The first chapter speaks of a decadent, corrupt Jerusalem, and the very last chapter, 66, speaks of a new Jerusalem. In chapter 4, verse 2, just the previous chapter, there is a great hope with reference to the glorious branch of the Lord. That refers to Jesus, the Messiah. It talks of his beauty. Isaiah is prone to just making these contrasts. So we have that contrast in chapter 4, but in contrast to that, we have chapter 5, which is very bleak and not much joy, really. But we see a movement in these chapters here, in chapters 1 to 5. They form a compact unit, culminating in Isaiah's call in chapter 6, where we have that vision of Isaiah, from Isaiah, a revelation of who God is. God is determined to do something, but what else can he do? We'll leave that question hanging there for the moment, but we're going to see that in Isaiah 5, there are some behind-the-scenes activity. And I think they're exciting things to look at. Just look out for those as we go through. Now, remember, Isaiah is addressing the southern kingdom of Judah and Jerusalem. This kingdom, though, is represented often by referring to it as Israel, because Israel are God's people. So don't be confused by that. So let's look at verses 1 to 7. This parable introduces the problem of Judah and starts in a way that is a little bit strange. Isaiah wants to sing a love song. And that was an appropriate song that we've just sung. It spoke about that. Isaiah knew his God, and to him, God was his beloved. He was the Holy One, we read in verse 19 and a couple of other verses as well. He knew the character of God. But to sing a love song? This was a decadent, unresponsive nation. This may have raised the hopes of the listeners at that time. Maybe Isaiah has something good to say about us. Maybe we are in the good books. But the nation had totally rejected their God, repudiated his laws. They were corrupted. Why would he sing a love song? Would you sing a love song to someone who had totally disowned you, rejected you, totally ignored you, wanted nothing to do with you. Isaiah knew that God wanted them back. In ancient times, there was a pattern in the justice system. Firstly, there is a complaint or accusation. We see this in verse 4. And following that, there comes judgment. The expectation was for beautiful, sweet grapes, but it yielded wild grapes, it says there. This actually means stink fruit. That's the actual interpretation of that. It's rotten fruit. You know, sometimes when you occasionally eat an apple, it looks good on the outside, and you get into it and it's rotten on the inside. Yuck. Rotten fruit. Nothing worse. That's what it was like. This fruit that Israel had produced was rotten. He went to great lengths to enjoy a permanent crop, we see there in verse 2. He cleared the rocks, prepared the ground well, even cut out of stone a vat that they could store the wine. He was looking for permanence, a lasting crop. But get this in verse 4, there was nothing more that could be done. Divine power exhausted? This, I think, would cause some self-examination on the part of the listeners of that day. Verses 5 and 6 announce guilt and judgment following the complaint that we've just spoken of. This is a picture of complete desolation of the vineyard. We ought to read those verses there, verses 5 and 6. And now I will tell you what I will do to my vineyard. I will remove its hedge, it shall be devoured. And note this, it says, note the I wills here in this passage. I will break down its wall. Verse 6, I will make it a waste. Later in verse 6, I will also command the clouds that they rain no rain upon it. This is the owner's decision. Foreign powers are alluded to there. It's a picture of total desolation. But what's starting to emerge here is the love of the owner for the vineyard. Verse 7 describes it as his pleasant planting. This actually means intense pleasure. Something is driving the owner for the good of the vineyard. Is there a glimmer of hope in that statement? It is clear, though, that the vineyard is the house of Israel. They are the culprits. They're the subject of this parable. And they're the subject of the remainder of this chapter. So this is an introduction to the problem of God's people. In verses 8 to 17, we have the first of two applications of this parable. These have a pattern of woes and consequences. And built within these woes is a lament, a cry, and there's implied consequences from them. These first two woes relate to excessive wealth. Judah just built on their wealth for their own individual pleasure. In verse 8, and it says in verse 9, it's basically all for naught. There's no lasting results out of it. This reminds me of the rich fool in Luke 12, who built up his portfolio of treasures. The woe in verses 11 and 12 implies self-indulgence. Their possessions, they actually revel in them. They have this insatiable desire, this appetite for pleasing self. They're totally enjoying themselves in their partying and drinking of wine. So what's the problem? We read in verse 12 clearly what the problem is, the real problem. The last part of verse 12. But they do not regard the deeds of the Lord or see the works of his hands. They totally ignore God. They do not see that their God is working for them. You know, in our fallen state, we are prone to ignoring God. Sometimes we can live like atheists. We live as if God doesn't exist sometimes. like the rich fool in the New Testament. You lay up treasures for yourself, and you are not rich towards God. This night, your soul will be required of you. After the woes, we have these first two woes, we have this connecting word, therefore, verse 13. So we have the consequences, verses 13 to 17. The consequences of this is judgment that comes upon them. There's a few things to notice here. Two things. Firstly, God calls them in verse 13, my people. God continues to seek a relationship with them in spite of their evil deeds. This is our God. This is the God of heaven. He initiates and pursues relationship with his people. God is a God of relationship. And we find in the Bible, right throughout the Bible, he is relentless in that quest. Isaiah points out that they are accountable to God. If we look at verse 16. But the Lord of hosts is exalted in justice, and the holy God shows himself holy in righteousness. This is a clear reason why they should repent the justice and holiness of God. As we examine our own lives, we need to do the same. We need to look at who God is. Look at his justice, his holiness. This should cause us to take stock. What are the things that occupy you and me that show that we are in relationship with our God and the Lord Jesus? The second thing to note here in these consequences is, secondly, is that Isaiah and the prophets generally have an immediate and future aspect. In verses 13, 15 and 17, they show immediate judgment and famine in the land. That affected them immediately, or very soon. In verse 15, there's a really serious humbling before God. In verse 17, is not an idyllic scene, but one of desolation of the land. The future aspect is in verse 14. As they have had an insatiable appetite for wealth and possessions, it refers to Sheol there. Sheol has even a more deadly appetite for the dead. And Sheol was a place for those that didn't know God. It was a place, the abode of the dead without God. So there is an eternal destination, an eternal judgment alluded to here. Verses 18 to 30, we now come to the second application of the parable. This group of four woes, there is a deeper penetration into the heart and into the mind. In verses 18 and 19, we have this image of the cart harnessed to an animal. That would be a very relevant illustration for them in their rural background there. The cart is drawn by the ropes. The idea here is that they are in bondage to their sin and iniquity. They can't break that bond. This explains their actions in the previous woes. They are so blinded by sin that they reject outright the claims of the Holy One of Israel. And they say there, come on, come near. Show us what you're going to do, they say there in verse 19. They're challenging their God. It's a serious thing, isn't it, to challenge God. Verse 20 and 21, we have what looks like, what is really, the universal nature of sin. It's a process. What is stated here is the results of being drawn into sin in the previous verse. James 1:14 says, we are lured and enticed by our own desire, which gives birth to sin and brings forth death. That's a process, isn't it? It's an inevitable process. What does this lead to? It's a corruption of the mind. Individual opinion results. There's no right or wrong. No absolute truth. Does this ring a bell for what we see around us today? Our society is now creating its own moral codes. We see this more and more. Same-sex marriage push. The LGBTI community pushing their agenda. These alternative lifestyles are an abomination to God. This is basically calling evil good. They're wise in their own eyes. Isaiah here is defining one of the fundamental problems of sin, corruption of the mind. And this is a product of man's fallenness. And these depravities that I've just mentioned, that's how they start. They start in the mind. Reason is thrown out the window. But God's people, and we are God's people, we are instructed to love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul and mind. Matthew 22. In Isaiah's day, the Israelites, they could not do it. They failed miserably. And it goes further for us. We today, as God's people, are instructed to renew our minds. We read that in Romans 12:2. One final woe in verses 22 and 23. Here we have those who are supporting evil practices, but not necessarily are doing these things themselves. The legal profession is mentioned here. The judges are guilty. And consequently, the innocent are affected. We see this today also, don't we? Injustices all around us. As God's people, we need to be fighting against evil. And I'm becoming more aware of that myself. Sometimes I'm just prone to sit back and do nothing. We need to be supporting these groups that are fighting against these evil influences around us. There's plenty of opportunity to do that. If we do nothing, are we abetting what's going on? What we see here also is a reveling in sin. It's an enjoyment of it. We saw this also back in verses 11 and 12, where they're reveling in their wine and drinking. It's a celebration of evil. Do we see this going on in 2017? Celebrating evil. Wine in the Old Testament was meant to be a celebration of God and who he was, who he is. Psalm 104, Deuteronomy 9. This was a gross abuse of the use of wine there in verse 22. Verse 24 introduces the consequences of this series of woes. There's another therefore there. There is increased intensity, you'll notice there, of the judgment upon them. There's this image of fire, and fire is a common expression of judgment in the Bible. This is utter destruction. The stubble and dry grass is utterly consumed and collapses into dust. This is the fulfillment of the image of the vineyard in verses 5 and 6. The key words there were that what was devoured, it was trampled down. It was made waste. Verse 25 highlights the anger of the Lord. Why is he angry? The answer is in verse 24, the last part of 24. They have rejected the law of the Lord of hosts and have despised the word of the Holy One of Israel. The holiness of God is a key theme in Isaiah. They have despised the Holy One. It's only in this context can we understand the anger of God. And it's only in this context can we understand the judgment of God. So what is the hope for this people? There's no good news coming even in the next verses. It's all doom. When you look for obedience from a dog, you can often whistle them. Dogs will respond to a whistle. They'll look up, they'll prick their ears, and if it's a good dog, they'll come to you if you tell them. So it's actually a signal for them to take note. In this case, we see in verse 26 that the Lord whistles the nations. These are the nations to come and bring about judgment, primarily Assyria. It's interesting, in the Old Testament, there's two ideas about whistles. It can be used in two ways. Here, it is alerting to judgment that is inevitable and will come with vengeance and authority. The second way is the whistle is used when God calls for restoration. We see this in Isaiah 49 and Zechariah 10. With the same authority, God will call and signal the nations to come to him with authority. And I think we see that happening in the world today when you see evangelism going on in many places. Finally, in verses 29 and 30, there is an irresistible predator, the lion. This was a powerful image of the day. The lion was the king in the animal world. The lion roars, "I'm going to get you," and it does. There is no rescue for Israel. The growl is the satisfied growl of a lion and its cubs munching on its prey. So darkness prevails, as Isaiah now turns to a seafaring analogy in the last few verses. The sea growls, and the sailor looks for refuge for the land, but finds no refuge. There's only darkness and distress. So Isaiah leaves us in hopelessness. If we go back to the vineyard in verse 4, is God's grace exhausted? It says there in that verse, there's nothing more could be done. The vineyard image is very common in the Old Testament. In the notes there, you'll see a whole bunch of references there. It's throughout the Old Testament. What is interesting in all these passages is that historic Israel is the vine that fails to bring good fruit. In every case, it's always used in a negative sense. And it's always used with a corresponding threat of God's judgment. So this is more bad news. Where is the good news? Where is the solution? What can God do? Well, the good news comes in John 15 that we read. Jesus says in verse 1 of John 15, "I am the true vine." Now, why did Jesus say, "I am the true vine," with the emphasis on the true? He is a true vine because he is comparing himself with the vine, which was Israel. Israel that had failed. The Jews in Jesus' day would have been aware of this image, so they would be thinking of the idea of being connected to the vine. So that's what the point Jesus is making. If I could go back to my garden and my passion fruit vine, there's something about this category of plants, and Rob brought this out in the children's talk this morning. If you prune a vine, as I did my passion fruit, you notice the prunings wilt fairly quickly, and they are rendered useless. They're only good for the fire or the compost heap, or maybe the dog to chew. So they don't last very long after they've been taken or cut from the vine, from the plant. Now, there's a comparison that other plants, like roses, for instance, you can cut off a rose and it stays beautiful for some time. It doesn't wither straight away. You cut down a tree and it's useful for good purposes. You can build houses with trees. Psalm 80 actually talks about that idea. Jesus is the fulfillment of Israel who failed so miserably. The question we need to ask is, are you connected to the true vine, Jesus Christ? He cannot fail. Why can't Jesus fail? Well, further in that verse, in verse 1, because his Father is the vine dresser. He is the gardener. Good fruit must result if we are in the vine. He has done the preparation. The Godhead is the guarantee. There must be good fruit. The lesson of the vine is, if you are not connected, you wither very quickly. Like Israel, your sin will control you, and you are doomed for destruction, as in verse 14, where the future eternal punishment was referred to there. Do we as believers have the fruit of the vine? If we don't bear fruit, John 15 says a little further on there that we're only fit to be cut off and burned. What God didn't do for Israel, he has done for you and me in Jesus. So what should we do? Well, this also came out in the children's talk, didn't it? We should be immersed in God's word and in prayer. We need to trust in Jesus, the true vine. And he indeed whistles for you today. Embrace him. He is life eternal.